707.
Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Well, Glenda the Good Witch had it right. There is no place like home. In cities and in suburbs across America, home is hot. Men and women of all ages, incomes, and interests are finding safe harbor and sound investment right in their own backyard, literally. For some, market forces are the key. Leaner times combined with lower interest rates are making buying a home and staying there the thing to do. For others, frightening dispatches from the world at large and the world just outside their doors give home a whole new sheen of security. And these homebodies are spending on shelter magazines, those glossy monthlies that trade in fantasy and offer it, at least until the last page, escape. They're spending on furniture and home furnishings. Sales keep rising to the tune of almost $92 billion last year, even as economic output in general is slowing. Some culture critics call this trend nesting, a return to home life and family values, to board game night, hugging your kids. Connection listeners, does homeward bound really mean head in the sand? Can there be such a thing as too much nesting? 1-800-423-8255 is the number to call. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined now by Pamela Paul. She's an editor at American Demographics magazine and the author of The Starter Marriage. She's in New York. And Jamie Pennybaker's with us. He's a professor of psychology at the University of Texas. He's joining us from Austin, Texas. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks for having me.
Pamela, let me start with you. You've been doing a little bit of research on this lately. What are you seeing?
Well, I think that there are both long-term trends that have been going on for quite a while, and those are combined with short-term trends of the economy and global instability. In the long term, I think that you need to look at generationally where the primary cohorts in this country are at. And what you're seeing is baby boomers are moving into the life stage where they're becoming empty nesters, and that's fueled a kind of nostalgia and a yearning for family. With Gen Xers, who are now in their 20s and 30s, they're now in their primary family building years. And this is a generation that grew up during a similar time of instability in the 70s, when divorce was rising, the economy was in recession, and they often grew up without families or stable families of their own. So they're yearning to capture sort of this never land that they didn't have.
Does it mean, though, Pamela, that the end result is the same, whether we're talking about the boomers or the Gen Xers, that they're spending all their time at, I don't know, Home Depot or the Pottery Barn looking for paint and placemats?
Absolutely. What you have is you have sort of three trends, I think, at once: a sense of nostalgia, a yearning for home and hearth, a traditionalism, and on the part of Gen X and boomers, really a kind of neo-traditionalism. We're not talking about going back to Ozzie and Harriet, because this is, after all, both groups have been more tolerant of different kinds of families. It doesn't matter what sort of family you have as long as you have one. And third, you're seeing a real sense of pragmatism and a focus on, you know, eliminating the extraneous, simplifying your life and focusing on what really matters.
And are there statistics from this industry that show that, in fact, people are spending more on, you know, fireplace implements than they were 5-10 years ago?
Absolutely. And I think that this is going to continue into the holiday season. You're seeing, you know, retailers like Pottery Barn and Crate and Barrel and Restoration Hardware and Target is up 11%. Vacuum cleaners, according to the Wall Street Journal, are the big gift this season. You know, again, focus on the home, real pragmatism. Yeah, ew. But, you know, my boyfriend just went out and bought his mom a vacuum cleaner. So it's clearly happening. And then on a larger scale, home sales are up. There was just a report that came out today showing that home sales have hit one of the three all-time high spots. And that's, you know, again, that has to do with low interest rates and with very favorable mortgage packages. But that's been going on for quite a while.
Jamie Pennybaker, I wonder whether or not what we're talking about here in the broad sense with Pamela is indirectly or directly linked to what's going on in the world today, to September 11th. I know that you've spent some 20 years studying the way people react to trauma and links between those experiences and their health, and you're looking at that now as well. What are you seeing?
Well, whereas Pamela is looking at a really large timeline, I've been focusing more on September 11th itself and looking at the kind of the psychological and social changes that brought about. And what we've been finding, looking at both kind of how individuals naturally talk with one another, as well as tracking how people use language on online journals like livejournal.com, what we've been finding is that ever since September 11th, people have changed in their language and the way that they are dealing with one another, that they tend to spend more time with one other person as opposed to larger groups. They're spending more time, when they talk, using more first-person plural, like we, us, and our, which is really suggesting kind of a drawing in. And our data suggests that September 11th and probably other things that are terrifying, the prospect of a war as well as the sniper in the East, all of this is in a sense, forcing people to draw in. And I think it's a natural reaction to the perceptions of an external threat.
I remember about this time last year, Jamie, we had a conversation not unlike this where we talked about, you know, people staying home, people holding hands, you know, who hadn't held hands for a long time, just as a reaction to exactly what you're talking about. And I guess I'm struck by your continuing to draw the line, you know, through a year and a half to those same effects still being a part of people's lives.
Well, I should say we're not following people as closely now as we did in the first 3 or 4 months afterwards. So it's harder to get a picture kind of what the culture, how the culture is talking and bonding together now. Mm. And this is where I think Pamela's data, it fits in nicely to suggest that it probably is going on.
I think that when you look at 9/11 and you look at the reverberations that has had, you can see this focus on my backyard. You know, first it was 9/11, and then it was the kidnapping scare of last summer, and then it was the sniper scare. And there is this sense that there's, you know, very dangerous, insecure forces out there, and what we need to do is sort of bunker down. But again, I do think that this does build on pre-existing long-term trends.
So you're going back to the generational argument that you were making earlier, Pamela. That
yeah, absolutely.
I get the sense that everybody responds to this kind of trauma by perhaps spending less time in large groups and more time in small groups. But how do you break it down for something like Gen X to make sense of it?
Well, looking at Gen X again, these are people in their 20s and 30s. They are focusing now. Those are the years where you make huge life decisions about marriage, about parenting, about family, about purchasing a home. So they were already in a place where these types of decisions were at the forefront of their mind. But studies do show that 9/11, of all the demographic groups that it impacted, really most strongly affected Gen Xers and Gen X women in particular. And I think that what you're seeing, again, is a number of Gen X women in particular. There's a small trend towards more women maybe cutting back on work, staying at home. Of course, the economy enters into that. And with parenting, a real sense of caution and a desire to be the ones who are there, taking care of, protecting, educating, making sure that sort of me and mine is taken care of.
I'm thinking as Pamela's talking, Jamie, about all the recent magazine cover photos of Sarah Jessica Parker's tummy and the, I don't know, maybe it's a fascination, maybe it's not, with pregnancy and pregnant mothers, and whether or not that could also be seen to be a part of this.
That's what, you know, I've noticed similar things, and it's as though the entire culture is now focusing on anything that's symbolic of family, symbolic of home, hearth, etc. So it seems to be pervading all aspects of the culture.
Tell me, though, in your view, whether or not it's just reaching back to the familiar, whether or not it's a yearning for nostalgia, or whether or not we're talking about something where there's a change taking place.
Well, there's definitely a change taking place, and has been taking place, at least for the last year and a half, and it really is confounded with the economy. So it's difficult to see what a fairly large-scale developing depression does or would look like versus an attack on the country. But both of those really bring about people's fear of death, fear of poverty, fear of all these, arouses all these insecurities. And any time any kind of insecurities are made more salient, what people do is they go to the familiar. So this is a very natural response.
I think when you talk about the economy, too, it's really interesting to note that these long-term trends in terms of parenting and women maybe cutting back on their participation in the workforce were originally seen as a sign of boom times. It was, you know, people said, well, they can, you know, people are earning enough money that you can afford to do this. And what will happen when there's a downturn? And yet, interestingly, even in the face of a downturn, and in part because of that downturn, those trends are intensifying because you do have job insecurity. There are fewer people on the, you know, on the job, and those who are more pressed for time. This is certainly not a period in which companies are going to be focusing on creating expensive family-friendly policies. Childcare costs have skyrocketed, and so those very same forces of economic instability are also leading people to focus on the family and focus on home.
What about, though, Pamela, looking at it from the other side and saying that, you know, because times are tough, people can't afford whatever type of entertainment they were doing, whether it was going out to a football game or going out to dinner at a restaurant, and that's simply why people are going home. It's less a question of choice but necessity.
I think it's both. I mean, you do have these, you know, instead of the latest restaurant or the latest nightclub being, you know, what's on people's agendas for Saturday night, it is looking at dinner parties, at family games, at small gatherings at home. And I think that, again, that does speak to a desire for that kind of entertainment, for that kind of safety and security and familiarity, as much as it does speak to the fact that, hey, people simply can't afford to go out the way they did.
Let me ask you, Pamela, the same question that I asked Jamie, and that is whether or not, in your view, it's emblematic of a change, or this is just one part of a cycle.
Well, you know, you had said, is it nostalgia or is it a move forward? And right. I think, again, it's both, because, first of all, to have a child is obviously to invest in your future, to invest in the long term and in a sort of sense of hope. And I think that does speak to a sort of forward thinking on the part of these 20 and 30 somethings. At the same time, yes, there is nostalgia at play. And with Gen Xers in particular, it's nostalgia for something that, again, they never really felt like they had. This is the children of divorce generation. These are the latchkey kids that grew up in families where their parents may have both been working or they may have only had one parent present. And so they do want to capture that sort of nuclear family that they didn't have growing up in their own homes. The 70s were really not a child-centric decade. And from the 90s onward, with the baby boom beginning to have children, you really saw a much clearer focus on children and on parenting. And I think you're going to see that again.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And Connection listeners, this notion that there's more nesting going on, that people are making the cave a little warmer, a little cozier, is that a good thing? Is it a bad thing? How do you view it? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Turn the thermostat up. Make the place a little warmer, a little cozier. 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about nesting this hour. With me on the program, Jamie Pennybaker. He's a professor of psychology at the University of Texas. And Pamela Paul's with us. She's editor at American Demographics magazine, author of The Starter Marriage. And we're joined now by Mark Mayfield from New York. Mark is editor-in-chief of House Beautiful magazine. Hi, Mark.
Good morning, Dick. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. Now, yours is, if I'm not mistaken, the oldest such magazine. The trade name is Shelter Magazine. Is that right?
Correct, yes. Literally for shelter over your head. House Beautiful is the oldest, 106 years old this year.
And you've been running these types of magazines for about 10 years. So tell me what you're seeing now and what you see that might be different or illuminating here.
Well, first of all, I agree with Jamie and Pamela in that there definitely is an upturn in this nesting instinct. I think that began before 9/11, but I think 9/11 certainly accelerated that. And I see that with the readers of House Beautiful. I think people in times of uncertainty, both in the economy and terrorism and all that sort of thing, the threat of war, people naturally turn to the home and to their family. And that's happened throughout history, and we're seeing it now.
How do you measure it at the magazine, Mark?
Well, first of all, there are certainly direct measures of it in terms of ad pages being up in the magazine for home furnishings, as well as the circulation of the magazine being up quite substantially over a year ago. And the other way we measure it is just looking at what's going on out there in terms of ownership of houses. Second home ownership, by the way, has gone up dramatically since September the 11th. And second homes, you would naturally think it's only for rich people, but it's also in parts of the country, a second home is not that expensive, and people really want a place to go, sort of nest and get away from the cities.
Help me now, place House Beautiful. You're not necessarily as highbrow as Architectural Digest. You're aiming at a kind of middle class, upper middle class clientele.
Yes, I think upper middle class is certainly correct. We're not at the highest end of the market, and we're certainly not a mass market magazine, but we're upscale, but I think very accessible.
And when you put the magazine together, whether or not you're, choosing, simple and sophisticated ways to throw a really good holiday party or whatever you're doing, is it as much fantasy that you're selling as genuine how-to tips?
Absolutely. I think part of a magazine like House Beautiful is aspirational. You know, not every reader can afford everything in the magazine, obviously. And certainly we photograph houses that are decorated by, some of the best decorators in the country. And not everyone, clearly most of the readers of House Beautiful do not have decorators. They can't afford them, or for whatever reason they don't have them. But I think they love seeing the beautiful rooms and taking ideas from those photographs and saying, I can do that in my living room, or I can decorate my mantle that way that I see in House Beautiful. It's all about ideas, and part of it is fantasy, sure.
Pamela and Jamie, the Shelter Magazine measure, is it one that you two agree is a useful way of trying to figure out where we're at?
Absolutely.
No, go ahead, Pamela.
I think that luxury right now, and our whole concept of luxury and what the ideal is, has really transformed from what it was in, say, the 80s and during the height of the dot-com era as well, which was, acquisition and really the finer things in life. Now our sense of luxury and the ideal is just having time to be with family, time to be at home. It's having children. It's being able to afford to have two or three children. It's having a welcoming, comfortable environment in which to have that family sheltered. So I do think that what Mark is talking about is accurate.
Jamie.
Yeah, the Mark measure is perfect. We know in psychology, if you're hungry, you want to look at food magazines. And if you're insecure about your money, you look at money magazines. And if issues of home are relevant, you're going to look at home-relevant magazines. So I think it's a beautiful measure to get a sense of kind of the national psyche right now of this nesting concept.
Yeah. I think also in times of like technology, if you think about it, in times of technology, when, right now this computer explosion and everything going on, people, if you look back through history, people sort of turn back though to the home and a simpler sort of life at home than the life they might have at work or that kind of thing. That's natural. And then it's accelerated by turmoil out there and all of that. So certainly the nesting instinct, is important in terms of that. And the other thing, I'll give the Shelter magazines credit for sort of expanding the taste level out there to just average Americans who who, again, have never been exposed directly to, you know, the great interior decorators and that kind of thing. But now they can. There are stores like Target and Pottery Barn and Crate and Barrel and all of these stores that you can go in and buy really great design furniture for a low price. And that did not exist when I was growing up.
Let's check in with some American homes. Our number is 1-800-423-8255 to Cambridge, Massachusetts. Gittle is on the line. Hi, Gittle.
Hi, how are you doing?
Fine, thanks for calling.
I'm listening to this conversation, and I understand the necessity for people to feel safe. But on the other side of this, and what I'm seeing is a tremendous amount of selfishness and isolation and people not reaching out to each other.
Be specific. Tell me what you're talking about.
Okay, I live in a community. I live in Inman Square, which has gone from being pretty much a lower, economic working class to maybe middle class environment to being very yuppified. Okay, you've maybe only got two buildings in my neighborhood that are still low income.
Right.
So what I'm really seeing in my neighborhood, and I've been around here for maybe almost 20 years, are people on the street, yes, who have the kids, and yes, who have the condos. Yes, they're running home to their little houses and their nice little Pottery Barn things, but they're not relating to anybody. And I'm certainly seeing that in the workplace as well. I do a lot of temp work, which a lot of people do. So I am working in offices all the time. I know that people are frightened. I know that people are scared since 9/11. And people have been scared actually before that. I think people were scared about the economy as well before that.
Okay, but come back to your point because it's interesting. I'm not sure if you've got a reason why people treat their home more as real estate than as part of a neighborhood.
Well, I think what it comes from, it's the 1970s. And I got to say, it's my generation's kids, and we did a really crappy job of raising them. Okay? And so they want to go back to this Brady Land fantasy that never existed that came off the TV set. These kids, no offense to them, my heart goes out totally, spent too much time in front of the television set, too much time going through magazines, looking at things that were very unreal, but that felt more satisfying than being in daycare, more dissatisfying than being children of divorce or single parents. And my dad was a single parent, so I get that. But here's
You're not going to tell me the Partridge Family was something that was real, was it?
Oh, not for me.
Okay.
But for a lot of people that I meet, it was substantially more real than the families they came out of. But here's the big problem. We live in a real world where there's, like, homeless people. That's very hard to deal with. And a lot of poverty, a lot of violence, a lot of difficulty. The less we reach out to each other to deal with these things, the less satisfying a real life we have. You can't get it all at Pottery Barn. You can't get it by buying the biggest house and overextending the crap out of yourself for 30 years to pay for it. You have to get it by reaching out to people and connecting with people, sometimes around things that are very, very difficult, like the fact that maybe your next-door neighbor doesn't have anything to eat for Thanksgiving and doesn't have any family.
Let me hear from Pamela on this. Nesting is hedonism, Pamela. This is something I hadn't thought
well,
of.
Well, you know, this is, a common characterization of Gen X, which is my generation, and I really think it's a mischaracterization. There is a temptation to say that, you know, this is a very selfish, self-centered type of movement, but I disagree. I think, again, it's very family-oriented. It's very community-oriented. I think that you're seeing this in the schools. I mean, again, this is very upscale, but there are preschools that won't even let you apply to it unless you, as
I'm
a parent, commit to
people.
Being there
I'm talking
in the
about
classroom.
Real people who aren't upscale, honey.
Okay, well then even
real
even
people who aren't making $50,000 a year, most people don't.
Even when you talk about middle-class Americans and working Americans, I do think that people are willing in this generation to cut back on an extra income, to cut back on a second income, to make a calculation, hey, the child care costs, the commuting, all of the costs that are sort of ancillary costs to going to the office every day aren't worth it, aren't worth the sacrifice in time, and that they are spending that time not only raising their families, but volunteering more in the schools and in the communities. And I think that you're going to start seeing a reversal of the kind of trend you're talking about, which I think is more of a yuppie late 90s type of trend.
Jamie, let's hear from you on this.
One thing that I've noticed is that in the last year, and I do think it's since September 11th, I do think there has been this retreat toward the home. And I've noticed in my neighborhood that people spend much less time outside, much less time with other people, that I do think that there is this retrenchment, and what the caller is suggesting I think is absolutely right, that I think that we are much we are devoting much more energy to our nuclear family than we are to the community.
See, now I'm caught because I'm thinking of families that perhaps ought to be spending more time with themselves, but you're saying that even that can go too far?
Of course, and everything can go too far. In fact, I was talking with my research group this morning about this very issue. When a culture becomes entrenched and we now spend more time with one other person, you look at all these benefits, you presumably develop a better relationship, etc. Then you have to ask yourself, well, why haven't we always done this? Well, one reason we haven't always done this is because there's also some value in going outside, spending more time with other people, partying more, as well as helping other people more. So, I mean, there's pros and cons to each, and that's why there are cycles over the course of history that we go from being much more spending more time in groups versus spending more time with one other person.
All right. Gittle, thanks for your call. Thought-provoking idea. Let's go to Plymouth, Massachusetts now, and Arlene's on the line. Hi, Arlene.
Hi. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling.
Yes. I'm going to make a point, and it's an observation, and then I'm going to take your responses off the air.
Okay.
I see a historical sort of parallel. I am a college professor, and at the moment I'm teaching popular culture in the late, really the 1850s.
That's before my time. What was popular culture in the 1850s that you're talking about?
Well, yeah, I'm gonna tell you a couple of things that happened, and then I'll make a connection to marketing. What happened in 1849, as I think you know, was the California Gold Rush. And what that did was, it sort of energized the population. And then a couple of things happened that really don't, I mean, they do make it into the history books, but not in a big way. But they were the kinds of sort of horror things that you know, have been happening. One of them was, I don't remember the professor's name, but it was a Harvard professor who murdered one of his students and cut the student up and I think stuffed him in a furnace or something. And the other one...
You're starting to lose me here, Arlene. What's the connection?
Okay. The connection, I just wanted to give you some examples. The connection is that there was a great sentimentalism that abounded in the 50s, and what happened is the dime novel became very popular, and the dime novel is the father of the sort of romance paperbacks and things that are very, very popular.
Right.
And so there was a great sentimentalism going on, and there was a great, push for family and safety. And then, you know, the next decade was the Civil War. Now, I'm not going to get into that, and, you know, we can argue the connection or not. But what's happening now is the same sort of thing. There are these sort of, in a sense, historically localized events that are happening now that are energizing the people in a certain way and creating that kind of hearth and home sentimentalism.
Arlene, let me take your point and see and bring Mark in here. I never thought of the Shelter magazine as having as one of its grandparents the dime novel of the 1850s.
No, I that's a new connection for me, I have to say. However, it's certainly, you know, no secret that history tends to repeat itself, and I think that again, in times of war, in times of turmoil, people are going to turn to the family. I do want to say one thing though about the earlier caller's comment. I absolutely do not agree that nesting means retrenchment. I don't see that at all. I think nesting means paying more attention to your house and your family, but you still have your friends. I think there's more charitable giving in this country today than there's ever been. I think none.
Although, but I hear what Gittle's saying with the sort of keeping up with the Joneses, and they're going to get a new sofa, so will I.
Right. I don't see that as. I think back during the 80s, you saw a lot of keeping up with the Joneses and that kind of thing. But I don't think it's about that. I think it's about keeping up with your family and paying attention to your family. I think it's more introspective, but it doesn't mean that it's exclusive of people outside your core family. I think in these villages and communities around the country, I think there's so many sort of charitable events and foundations now that did not used to exist. And I think people actually feel an obligation to be involved in that.
Pamela, you were going to say something.
Yeah, I also think that, you know, keeping up with the Joneses doesn't go away. And I do think that it's here, but I think it's here with a twist, which is that in the 80s and even in the 70s, a dual income family who strove after their careers was really seen as the ideal that you wanted to shoot for. Whereas today, I think that the one income family who has a lot of time to spend together, who can take care of the home and take care of the children, is seen in this idealized light. And that, if anything, couples will look at a family where the mother can, you know, say work part-time from home or have her own part-time business that she's started up. And they see that as, wow, that's luxury. I would love to be able to quit my job, you know, stay away from the sort of corporate rat race and do something more like that.
Right.
Jamie, I'm wondering, though, and I'm back on the question of nostalgia here, whether or not that kind of yearning for what was goes so far as to, gee, I'd really like to make a pumpkin pie from scratch, which is more fantasy than reality.
Again, it's probably this, it's part of this cycle of history, I think. That is, if I grew up in a world where we didn't get to do it, now is this opportunity to do it, I'll do it. It's very interesting. One thing that happens in terms of historical trends is that trends tend to occur in 20 to 25 year cycles, and people are influenced particularly if events occurred to them between the ages of about 12 and 25. So each generation has their own. Mine was the Kennedy assassination in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And what happens is about 25 years after those events, we want to build monuments, we want to look back, we want to construct our history around what happened between the ages of 12 and 25. If pumpkin making was a big thing for me back when I was 15 years old, by God, I want to do it now if it's 25 years later. So a lot of historical issues or this sense of nostalgia is based, and this is exactly what both Pamela and Mark are talking about,
right,
on things that occurred earlier in our lives. And now when we're in this insecure period and it's sufficiently far in the future, we go back to it.
Connection listeners, do we look back to our own history and try to reclaim some of what was familiar and comfortable in at a time when we're nesting? I'll take this opportunity to say thanks to Mark Mayfield for joining us.
Oh, thank you. Thanks,
nice to have you on the program, Mark. Mark's editor-in-chief of House Beautiful magazine. Connection listeners, when we come back after the break, more about nesting. 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. I'm Dick Gordon. With me on the program today, Pamela Paul, editor at American Demographics magazine, author of The Starter Marriage, doing research on the trend of nesting that we're talking about on the program, and Jamie Pennybaker, who's a professor of psychology at the University of Texas and has spent some 20 years looking at the way that we react to trauma, both in the way that we relate to other people and the way that we behave under circumstances that are a little bit frightening. Nesting, Connection listeners, 1-800-423-8255. We'll go first to Louisville, Kentucky, and Chris is joining us. Hi, Chris.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you for having me.
What do you think?
Well, I think that the whole idea of nesting is a political message, and I think it's coming from our elected leaders, and I think the message is, be afraid, go home, and don't engage in politics. Leave it to us.
Okay.
The reason I think that is partly due to the USA Patriot Act, which guts the Freedom of Information Act and lets Americans participate less in their own government. I think this is an extremely dangerous trend, and I think these people are not democratic. I think that they are against.
Do you think that it's part of a plan, Chris, that they say, look, let's put out a terrorist alert this weekend so everybody stays at home and we'll keep people kind of on edge or off balance?
I think it's more of a not let's keep everybody at home this weekend, but I think it's a general sense of fear that they're trying to encourage And the reason I say that is if you look at the major players in the Bush administration, Mr. Rumsfeld and Mr. Cheney were part of the Ford administration, which was very much against the Freedom of Information Act, and which allows us to find out what our government is doing, such as the COINTELPRO program.
Well, no, wait, hang on a second here. I want to try and sort of keep it on the subject of nesting. And what I'm going to take from your call, Chris, is that this isn't some spontaneous reaction to circumstances, but some bit of political manipulation. Am I right?
Is it at all hard?
Oh, we've just been joined by some other radio program from space. Chris, are you still there?
I am, uh-huh.
I'm just going to take that. Did I put your point accurately there?
Yeah, I think it's opportunism by our elected leaders.
Pamela, what do you think? Oh, Pamela's not there. That was what was happening with our cross wires. Okay, Jamie, you're up.
Okay, and the backup on this one.
Yeah, sure. I'm not asking you to give your necessary inside take on the Oval Office, but...
The fact is when something like September 11th comes along, it terrifies the hell out of everybody. It is a cultural affront. It makes all of us nervous. And kidnappings and sniper shootings are all things that push this as well. Mm-hmm. Is there some kind of planning on the part of the administration to boost anxiety? That to me is almost a separate question. I could see in some ways the answer would be yes, and their attitude might be trying to protect us. The point is that when we are we perceive ourselves under threat or siege, humans always, and by the way, not just humans, but all primates and other animals as well, and get back into small groups and do what they can to put themselves in a more secure position.
By small groups, you don't mean schooling like fish. You mean the nuclear family that you were talking about?
Actually, schooling like fish is a very good example. If a shark comes into the water and you've got a school of fish, what they do is they all get into a much tighter group of fish. The same thing with packs of dogs and with humans as well. When there is an external threat, symbolic or real, what happens is we get into smaller groups. It's a natural instinct, if you like.
All right. Chris, thanks for your call. We're going crosstown now. Also, Louisville, Kentucky. Lynn's joining us. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. Thanks for calling.
Well, I'm calling because I'm an interior designer, and I actually work in Indiana. I'm on the road right now, but
okay.
I specialize in kitchen and bath design.
You busy?
Am I busy? Yeah, that's just it. I am busy. And there was a real initial reaction. Things slowed down a little bit right after September 11th. People were nervous. But now I'm getting busy with people that are basically revamping their homes to reach in more into their family, to give themselves rooms that allow them to be together in huge ways for entertaining other people, for their own families.
And what are you saying, Lynn, that it's not recovering the couch?
A lot of it in my business is not, and it also, unlike a few years ago, it's not keeping up with the Joneses. It isn't, my neighbor has a new kitchen, I want a new kitchen. It's, I want a kitchen where my kids can do their homework when I cook at night. I want a bathroom where I can bathe all my grandchildren and be comfortable and really develop rooms, knock down walls, and develop areas where they're all together.
Pamela Paul, are you back?
Yes, I'm back.
We lost you for a bit there.
I got disconnected. I wanted to make a comment about what the earlier caller had said about what the sort of possible negative political repercussions of this trend can be. And I think that while what he says has a certain legitimacy to it, I also think that if you look at the trend of nesting, that in a way it doesn't have to be so insular as to be isolationist, because when you talk about a time of global instability and finding a reason to sort of fight against what we perceive as a threat, I think that what strengthens our resolve all the more is focusing on the values and the institutions and the things like family and home that we do have the opportunity to have, in a way, can, again, strengthen that resolve against outside forces.
But what Lynn's talking about now is, in a way, a different kind of nesting. It's a reordering of priorities within the home.
Oh, definitely. I think there is. I think that there is a priority. Again, it's not the kind of keeping up with the Joneses that has to do with having the latest, home equipment or the, best decoration. It really has to do with having the most comfortable home that you can have, with having the time to spend in that home that I think is what people are after. Those are the priorities on people's minds, not the acquisition of luxury items.
Now, Lynn, not a lot of us can afford an interior designer. In your experience, is this something we're talking about that's happening just at the upper level of society?
Actually, in my particular business, I deal with middle class, upper middle class, a $50,000 a year plus type of consumer. And I am dealing with people that are making around the $50,000 a year area that are saying we are going to spend the money we have on our home right now, which they didn't really prioritize that I'm going to hire a designer and I'm going to spend my money. I'm going to take out a home loan while they're low, and I'm going to take on the debt to put it into my home. And I didn't see that 5 and 6 years ago.
Lynn, thanks for your call.
You're welcome.
Let's go to Fletcher, Vermont now. Claire's joining us. Hi, Claire.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Yes. I deal in a nostalgia item, as a matter of fact, old upright pianos. And in January, after 9/11, I ran out of pianos. And these are refurbished. And probably 70% of the people that buy upright pianos are buying them because they're in their 40s, say, and they remember taking piano lessons when they were children. They want to get back into it. Other people are actually, I have heard, I think a house should have a piano. And what they're talking about is, I think, a return to a simpler life. It's not video. It works when the power goes out. There is an image of people sitting around the piano, listening to children play, or at Christmas time, all singing together. And they are after the old. They specifically are calling, I want an old upright. They're not asking for a used piano.
I wonder, Claire, if you're ever able to follow up enough and know whether or not anybody's actually bothering to take piano lessons and learn to play it, or whether or not it sits there like a piece of nostalgic furniture.
You're cruel.
No, I go back and I tune them, every 6 months.
So people are playing them?
Oh, yes, they're playing them. They're asking me for, where can I buy music? Who's a good music teacher? All of these questions. And certainly if you think about the earlier part of the last century, every house did have a piano until radio came along.
Don't say anything bad about radio.
No, I love radio. I'm a ham radio operator, as a matter of fact. But
now, Jamie Pennybaker, you were catching me there, being a bit of a cynic.
Well, this is something I've always been fascinated with, is how so many of the things we purchase, we move into, are these symbolic moves, but we often don't take advantage of them.
Right.
For example, you do build the new bathroom so you can bathe all your grandkids, but the reality is the grandkids still never come over, or when they come over, they're already clean. So in fact, I think a lot of these purchases, it's really interesting to hear all of this, I think very often are symbolic, that they are things that we perceive that we really need right now, that make us feel more comfortable, more at home. Whether or not we use them, in some ways, is almost irrelevant. We need the symbol of security.
And Claire, that's what the piano is representing.
Yes, but I think it's also, however feeble, a real attempt to reject a lot of what's going on in the modern world.
Now, obviously, it's good for you if you're in the business of refurbishing them, but when you're talking about what people are rejecting in order to reach out to the piano, what are they rejecting, Claire?
Well, the culture of video games.
Not necessarily rejecting the evening news.
No. But also, the piano is something that you have to be an active participant in.
Right.
You don't watch it and walk in, throw on a switch, and it works. I mean, the kind of pianos I'm talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
So there's participation. It's not a passive object in your home.
Jamie, you were going to say something?
Yeah. I think one thing that you're rejecting rejecting isn't really the right word, is if you're going to be spending that much more time at home and playing the piano, you're not going to go out to the movies as much. You're not going to go out to eat as much. You're not going to spend more time out in public. So in a sense, you're rejecting that part of the world to have a richer time at home.
And Pamela Paul, I'm thinking of one of the notes that I got about the work that you're doing. You're also noticing that there's an increase in the sale of board games. Is that right?
Right. Board games, parlor games, hobbies, things like piano playing that the caller is talking about. And these are, you know, serve multiple purposes. They're family and group oriented. They involve often skills. They're obviously amusing. They're inexpensive. So that sort of tends to both the nostalgia traditional stream that you're seeing as well as the pragmatic, economically reinforced stream of trying to find sort of easy, simple, inexpensive ways to spend time.
And we talked earlier in the program about whether or not this was something that preceded, came as a result of 9/11. But let me ask the two of you, and Claire, I'll just take this moment to say thanks for your call about the piano. It's an interesting idea. But to both Pamela and Jamie, whether or not this is something that will run its course, or whether or not we're looking at a change.
I think that one of the important things to keep in mind is that it's easy to read very negative repercussions into these kind of trends. One is the sort of geopolitical potential for isolationism that we talked about earlier. The second is when you look at people focusing on children and parenting, there's a question, you know, is this rolling back the women's movement? Mm-hmm. Are we regressing? And I think that the answer is absolutely not. And I think that what we are seeing is really, again, a progression of what the previous generation did, which was open up new choices. Now women are saying, okay, let's take those choices. Let's make those choices. And it's not necessarily permanent, because what you're seeing right now, again, particularly with women in their 20s and 30s, if they are going home, their children are very young. These are people who are the most educated generation of mothers ever.
Jamie, I need to hear from you, because I'm a little short for time here.
On one level, I agree with Pamela. On the other is everything is cyclical. So if there's a retrenchment to home and family, it may last for 20 or 25 years at best or worst, depending on your perspective. And then those kids are going to react against that. The fact is there's things always change, which is lucky, or I'd be out of business.
Okay, you two, mark down on your calendar. 20, 25 years from now, we'll just test this again. Jamie, thanks for being with me.
You bet.
Jamie Pennybaker is a professor of psychology at the University of Texas. Pamela Paul, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Pamela's an editor at American Demographics magazine, author of The Starter Marriage. Earlier in the hour, we talked with Mark Mayfield, editor-in-chief of House Beautiful magazine. Our program is produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Orit Karitsky-Fox, Allison McAdam, Lindsay Miller, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Tara Murphy's our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. To purchase cassettes and CDs of The Connection, please visit www.theconnection.org or phone 1-800-909-9287.
This is W.